Oh boy, welcome to This Week in Science here on KDBS 90.3 FM. My God, we've got some treats for you today.
Yes, we do.
Got Jamie and Robin from the Sacramento Zoo coming up at the 9 o'clock hour from 9 to 9:30. We'll be talking with them about stuff going on at the Sacramento Zoo. And as a special treat this morning, oh my gosh, we've got William Gibson on the phone. No, for reals, we've got William Gibson on the phone.
Just
a little quote. In terms of concrete influence, William Gibson is probably the most important novelist of the past two decades. The world would be different without him. That's from Stephen Poole, The Guardian, October 30th, 1999. And it's apt.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know or do know and just want to confirm that this is really the guy, we have the author, hopefully, of Neuromancer, Johnny Mnemonic, and the man who invented the term cyberspace.
Hopefully he'll be calling back.
We had him there for a second, and now it seems we lost him. But anyway, yeah, we got that. An interview and a little bit of science to bring you.
Yeah, so it's a big morning this morning. We're here from 8:30 to 9:30, and it's going to be a lot of fun. We hope he calls back, and he should be calling back. He called at the top of the show. So.
In the meantime, you can always give us a call at 530-752-2777. I don't know that we'll be allowing any questions during the Gibson interview, seeing as we have such limited time, but you can always try and give us a call. Also, please check out our websites, www.thisweekinscience.com, where you can find forums, archives of old shows that we're trying to update as we speak, and also occasional stories. It seems that Gibson is calling us back, so let's get him on the air.
Hello, Mr. Gibson? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, hi, it's William Gibson, and I was holding for Ted Denning to do the This Week in Science.
That's right.
And I got cut off on my end, but I got the switchboard sorted so it won't happen again.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for calling back, and you're on the air right now. So.
Okay.
We're really excited to have you on the show. Thank you for agreeing to
be
part of it.
And you're speaking to us from Seattle today? Wow.
And you normally live up in Vancouver, I hear. Is that correct?
Yes, I do. So I'm not even outside of my regular biosphere, really.
Now, the rumor is you're going to be down in this neck of the woods in Emeryville tomorrow. Is that correct?
Well, it's so early in the tour that I'm still looking at the schedule, but I believe that is the case.
So you got the PR people and the agents kind of running you around?
Well, mostly my publicist and her large, thick schedule, which I've not yet digested. Yes, Barnes & Noble in Emeryville. That's on Feb 4.
Yeah. That's I believe that's tomorrow.
That's right. these tours just roll along.
So for this tour, are you promoting a new book, or is it just a tour because you feel like getting out and touring the country?
Well, it's neither. This is on the occasion of the paperback publication.
Pattern recognition?
Yes, of pattern recognition. And my impression has been that publishers primarily collect their profit on the paperback. So
I think that's true. I have to admit, sir, I read Pattern Recognition in the hardcover, but I borrowed the copy from a friend.
Well, I don't blame you. I don't think I bought a new hardcover book until I was in my late 30s.
Fantastic. It's nice to know that we're par for the course here.
Now, you know, so when I look at what books cost now in hardcover, I'm stunned that people buy them.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always like, you know, shaking hands extra hard when people turn up with the hardcover.
I think the hardcover versions probably end up being the bookshelf trophies. You know,
yeah,
the things that people want to keep that they know they're never going to sell back to some used bookstore, that those are the ones that are going to stay on the bookshelf.
Well, they don't turn all yellow and sulfury like paperbacks do. There's something dismaying about a 20-year-old paperback.
It looks like it's lived hard, hard, long life.
Yeah, it's kind of like old yogurt or something.
Excellent. So can you tell us, obviously pattern recognition's coming out in paperback now, so it's been out for a while, and I know that you've been writing a weblog in some of this intermediate time, and you stopped some months ago, but are you working on something new?
Well, there's, you know, great lumps of unidentifiable gristle are starting to surface in the creative pot, and that's a good sign, but it doesn't leave me with too much to think about. Although one of those lumps of gristle is about how one can really be a conservative in a situation in which history itself has become sort of a dubious entity. Like how do you do the don't fix it if it ain't broke, if you don't, you know, you can't really agree on what the past was like.
That's interesting.
That is interesting. Reinterpretation of the past by conservative folk, making it an untenable situation now.
Yeah.
Yes, it seems like you'll be writing about present day then.
Well, it might be a topical piece of gristle.
Right.
I've come to... I've always thought that I was a very topical writer in my, you know, quiet way, and everyone always said, whoa, he's writing about the future, and I always said, no, I'm writing about Reaganomics or whatever was happening. And somehow it seems to have come around to my actually being able to do that, but you know, still being able to use basically the same set of tools, which I think is interesting.
Now, you use terms like gristle, and I assume these are professional writerly terms.
No, they're personal writerly terms. Writers, there aren't terms really in the trade for the things that writers do. So on those occasions when two writers collaborate, there's an interesting process. You have to invent a shared language for different parts of the creative process.
Do you find that's what happened when you wrote The Difference Engine with Bruce Sterling?
Yes, absolutely. I was thinking of that. There was a point in writing that where we had discovered that there was a great plot twist that needed to be introduced, say, back in chapter 3, and it would affect everything else that happened in the rest of the book. So when we agreed on that, Bruce said, okay, you go back to chapter 3 and change it, and I'll go to chapter, you know, I'll go through to chapter 24, which is as far as we'd gotten, and he said, I'll do the backfill.
Okay.
And ever since then, I appropriated that term, and I call that part of the process doing the backfill.
Sounds like a construction term.
Yeah. Well, it feels like writing a novel for me. Maybe I need to give it some kind of more butch interpretation than it deserves. But it feels to, you know, it feels like working a mind face, the part of the text where you're actually moving forward into nothingness, and right. it feels like being one of those transatlantic tunneling machines, grinding away at a dank, dark rock face.
Constantly, for 3 years.
You make it sound like work.
Well, it feels like work, or sometimes I think it feels sort of like driving from New York to Los Angeles. It can be kind of enjoyable. There's a lot to see along the way, but it's a haul.
Right.
Well, we had another question. question. I mean, there's a lot of speculation on the internet, rumors flying around here and there, different stories. What about Neuromancer, the movie? And this is like kind of a diehard fan question, but can you give us any info on that?
No, I think Neuromancer's the...
Do you get asked this all the time, sir?
Well, people have been asking me this for, you know, nigh on to 20 years, and it's gone back. It looked, you know, there were rays of hope for a while, but now it's sort of gone back to its ordinary, vague status of being optioned, but no director is assigned, and
right.
You can't. I've had almost everything I've ever written has been optioned forever, and nothing happens until a director gets on board, because that's when you get like studio financing.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't really happen before that. So I had hopes for a certain director, but that doesn't seem to have worked out. So the people with the option are looking for another director.
And I guess a lot of people kind of have this misconception that as an author, if you option a book, or commonly thought, sell a book for a movie, you don't really have a whole heck of a lot of control over it from there, do you?
Well, if you don't ordinarily, and if you find yourself, if you somehow get yourself into a position where you do have some kind of control over it, it can kill you. Because
right.
When people get, when you get like large corporations with like 20 or even a mere $20 or $30 million invested in something,
yeah,
and the weight of that is sitting on your head as this hapless author who somehow wound up with a degree of creative control, that's really not a great situation.
Yeah.
And the author is not in, you know, 99% of the time, the author is not going to profit hugely from the film.
True.
Even if it's like an enormous success, the authors of the original material are not the people who make big money.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another very widespread misconception in the world, is that if your book gets made into a movie, you'll make a ton of money, and it's usually not true.
It's unfortunate.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Sony in some way related to the Johnny Mnemonic movie?
Well, Johnny Mnemonic wound up as a Sony film. It began as a total lowball indie Canadian movie, and by the time it was in the can, it was a really pretty expensive Sony
mm-hmm.
movie.
Okay.
And since it was, you know, it was their money, that enabled it to be finished, they had an awful lot to say about what it looked like when it finally came out, or an awful lot of responsibility to bear.
That's almost a better way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, if truth is stranger than sci-fi, what's the wackiest thing that you've encountered recently? The thing that made you stop in your tracks and go, oh my God, I am living in the future. Anything?
Let me see.
Can't
the
tell
wackiest,
me.
Wackiest. It would, any one of a dozen sort of, you know, domestic political events in the United States over the last couple of months. nothing that most people would identify as futuristic. But, you know, some people might identify those things as Orwellian.
Yeah, that's true.
Absolutely.
Yeah, people don't realize that the 80s have come and passed, and we've actually lived through them, so.
Yeah.
A long time ago.
Have you have you visited California since we've had our new governor?
No, I haven't. I hadn't even thought of that. That puts a whole kind of postmodern spin on it. I'll be like...
Oh, yeah, you should try living here, man. It's nice.
We'd love to welcome you when you come to Emeryville, to the land of the gubernator.
Yes. Well, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah, I haven't really thought about it. He seems, in the rest of the world, he's kept a pretty low profile.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
Well, you've got all these crazy people running around right now. I mean, he kind of fits into the cast of characters. I mean, he's got his place and he's got
his role. Actually looks pretty normal. Good example of trying to remain conservative in wacky times like these.
Yeah, absolutely, right? That, look at him. He's a conservative.
And he used to beat people up for a living.
He's great. I know. He's like, he's post-human in Bruce Sterling's sense.
He is a man of the people. Well, you know, when you're down here, we'd like to remind you, you're going to be in Emeryville, the Barnes & Noble. You actually have a beautiful view from that Barnes & Noble of the Bay Bridge, and they're constructing a new, futuristic, completely modern Bay Bridge, a new span there. So you'll be able to see the old one, which is the cantilever side, where they used to grow chickens and marijuana in your earlier trilogy. And so just want to let you know to check that out. And you can't have read those books living here in the Bay Area if you're a fan of your work. Every single time you drive into San Francisco across that bridge, you're looking at property. You know, you're just like,
right.
I'm driving through a dance club right now. Oh, now it's a country and western bar.
Well, that was my single most successful act of appropriation.
Nicely done, sir.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I kind of have the hopes that when they put up the new span, that they won't take down the old span.
Oh, yeah.
And that we'll actually be able to start building on it.
I think we're going to have to lobby based on the steal
yeah,
some
can't
of your ideas.
Down. You know, the old span should be, you know, even if they just let it rust, it would, you know, that thing is like that's a national treasure. Did you know that there's a deliberately constructed enormous camera obscura in one of the concrete pylons of that bridge?
No.
When you go inside, there's a hatch that if you've got the keys, the governor could do this. If you go inside, I'm not making this up, you go inside this hatch and you're in this enormous, damp, cold, weird, totally dark place, and when your eyes adjust to the darkness, if it's a clear day outside, you see on the opposite wall this huge, round, inverted image of San Francisco.
Really?
And the guy who designed the bridge liked camera obscuras, and he knew that all he needed was to order a little tiny hole to be left in a particular place.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic.
I read a book about that bridge when I was researching that book, and that was the fact that it's like the thing in San Francisco I would most like to see.
Wow, I've never heard of that. I wonder how
I
you
think
get
it's probably
the
one of the least well-known things about
yeah,
San Francisco.
Yeah, it's like it's a
well.
Secret treasure of the city, and it's happening in there all by itself every sunny day in San Francisco.
So no one's actually seeing.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, maybe there are people, you know, maybe like really old families who have the key.
Yeah, people
like,
who have
go
the
in
keys.
And, go in and have picnics or something.
What a pleasant place to have a picnic.
Oh, you got to find a way to do that. You're going to be in the area. You should make some calls.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a mayor or somebody that can
help. Yeah, I should talk to Wired. They're always trying to get me to go to interesting places. That one's actually close to their offices.
Oh yeah, right. Man. Get them to work for you. Take you up there. That would be awesome.
I'm sure they could do it. Last question I have is, who do you read?
Who do I read? My big favorite for over the last decade, and he's still hanging in there, although he hasn't had a book for a while now is an English writer named Ian Sinclair. That's Ian with two I's.
Mm-hmm.
And he's really fairly well known in the UK and scarcely read at all here. And he writes these indescribably wonderful and peculiar psychogeographical investigations of London, which resemble novels to some degree, but are more like really intense, sort of micro-scale travel books, in a way.
Huh.
Would we find them in nonfiction?
Well, sometimes, yeah. Actually, the last one, I was looking all over London for it, and it turned out they had it in travel books, which I thought was hilarious. And
that one's called
Circular Orbital, and it's about a year-long hike around the M25, which is sort of London's beltway.
Yeah.
And he'd go out every week and walk a certain distance around this thing, and then write about what he had seen. And it's impossible to explain how great these books are if you're me. they don't work for everybody.
You like place. I mean, that's important to your writing, isn't it?
Well, I've come to realize more and more that I do like that. But I also like sort of no place. Like, I'm something that you don't see very much of in writing today is meticulously accurate naturalistic description of the kinds of environments that most urban Americans inhabit most of the time. And that was part of, I really wanted to describe in pattern recognition, to at least describe the interior of one Starbucks in some detail. Because, you know, lots of people have things in novels that happen in Starbucks, but nobody ever says what it looks like.
Uh-huh.
And somehow there's value in doing that.
Describing exactly the Starbucks that could be anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the thing. Most people probably don't describe it because they just figure everyone knows what Starbucks looks like.
Well, we won't in another decade because
exactly.
they'll have changed the light fixtures.
Mm-hmm.
Across the board. Oh, God. Well, it seems that we're kind of butting up against time constraints here, but we'd like to thank you, Mr. Gibson, for coming on and speaking to us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It has been our pleasure, and we'd like to let everyone listening know that Mr. Gibson will be here in the flesh in Barnes & Noble, Emeryville, tomorrow evening, I believe at 7:30. And get a chance to see this man if you're in the neighborhood.
Well, thank you. I will be there in any case.
And, you know, actually, at this Barnes & Noble, I was just there last week, they have a Starbucks in the store, probably right next to where you'll be speaking.
Well, that's very good. That's kind of a standard fixture and handy for the touring author.
Well, we'll be there tomorrow, and I'll have to buy you a cup of coffee or something.
Okay, it's a double short, no fat.
Fantastic.
We appreciate it, and hopefully we can get you on again sometime.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Mr. William Gibson, author of his latest novel, Pattern Recognition, author of Neuromancer, Burning Chrome, Mona Lisa Overdrive, The Bridge Series, The Sprawl Series. Yes, Hugo, Philip K. Dick, and Nebula Book Awards to this man. It was a pleasure speaking to him. And, my God, we spoke to him for like 20 minutes.
That's pretty cool.
Holy jeez.
Touch me.
These boys here have been waiting for this moment.
Oh, my God.
Anticipating nervously. I have to say, I think you guys handle yourself.
Did we comport ourselves?
You had so
aplomb?
Much composure. You very, very, very well
handled. Yeah, I'm going to go absolutely nuts now.
Yeah, no more throwing up from nervousness today.
Oh, that was so cool.
It was so weird. Oh, wow, that's awesome. That's one to go down for the agents, and hopefully we can have him back on again.
Absolutely.
Quick break, then.
Quick break, and then we're going to be joined by two lovely young ladies, I believe.
From the Sacramento Zoo, Jamie and Robin talking to us about what animals, education programs, events, et cetera, they've got going on at Sacramento Zoo. You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM, This Week in Science. Stay tuned. It gets better.
The following hour of programming may not be suitable for all audiences, since it may contain material which may be perceived as objectionable. Parental discretion is advised. The views presented in this hour do not reflect the views of KDVS, KDVS sponsors, or the University of California.
Welcome back to KDVS 90.3 FM. This Week in Science, we're going to be here till 9:30. In studio, we've got Jamie and Robin from the Sacramento Zoo.
Hello.
Hello. How are you guys doing this morning?
Just fine. Great. We've had coffee, so we're good to go.
That's more than I can say for myself.
I've had herbal tea.
That's all right. I'm just functioning off of pure adrenaline right now. It's fantastic. Oh. So how's the tiger? I can't remember the name of the tiger. You told me the name at one point, Jamie. And at this,
we have actually two tigers.
But the male one that chuffs at you.
Castro.
Castro, that's right.
He's very playful. He's doing just fine. And then we actually got approval to breed the two tigers. So we're trying to do introductions between the male and female and see if we can get that set up. So
how hard is it to get tigers to like each other? Like, what's the probability that they're actually going to get along?
Well, they go through stages where you put them together in behind the scenes where they've got a separation between them so that they can sniff each other, smell each other, sort of see their body language and stuff like that. And then you wait until they get relaxed where they're actually lying down next to each other and totally relaxed. And then you can start doing the real introductions, which is when they're in the same space together.
And that's the more difficult because of the territoriality of the cats,
right? Yeah, a lot of cat species are pretty... They live in separate worlds except for breeding season. Right. So the only ones that are really, really social are lions. So it's always a little bit like, okay, are you all right? Are you all right? Okay, we'll put you together.
I think human breeding should be conducted in much the same fashion.
I've heard that... you're funny. Sometimes I agree, too. Coming down here, being with you guys every week.
This is very much like an exhibit. You can close the doors, viewing windows from the side. All we need is like a hose to, you know, keep things under control. And
hose you two down. Oh, dear.
You're too kind.
So, I don't know. I've heard that in most cat species, it's the female that's the more territorial of the two, male and female. Is that correct?
Usually... Well, she's the choosy one, if you want to put it that way, in biology terms. Right. It's the female that's making the choice on the male, whether he stands up looks like he's a big, strong guy that's going to have good offspring. But usually it is the males that are more territorial out there in the wild.
Oh. All right, then.
You thought it was going to go the other way, didn't you?
Huh? No, well, I guess it might be territory size, just, you know, comparing against the house cats around, you know. Oh. I live in this apartment complex that is filled with female cats. There's so many female cats and only a few male cats. And it seems like the female cats have these specific territories staked out, and they only go to particular areas, whereas the males, they just take off and wander all over the place, and it doesn't really matter. They'll step on anyone's territory.
Yeah, you know? What you're seeing is sort of similar to what you see in the wild, where the females have smaller territories, and the male's territory actually encompasses a number of female territories. So he has a bigger territory to patrol, if you want to put it that way.
Right.
But yes, the females do have territories, definitely.
Cool, we got off track talking about tigers there.
Tigers are cool.
I love tigers, and I love castors.
I actually have one more tiger question.
Cool enough.
I've heard this anecdote several places, and I've always wanted to check with a zoo professional if it's true or if you've heard anything about it. And the rumor is about tigers in zoos being given, like, industrial-strength catnip and just having these incredible reactions where they'll, like, do all sorts of gnarly stuff, like...
They're looking.
We're puzzled by the question.
You never heard this. Okay,
I've never heard of any sort of industrial catnip, but we do for enrichment for some of our cats for just to kind of give them something else to think about. We do use spice, like cinnamon and nutmeg, ginger, that kind of thing. We'll put it on boxes or trees, and it seems to just set them off because it's so different. And so they tend to have kind of a catnip reaction to that, where they'll rub and, you know, kind of get really lovey onto whatever it is.
It's the party for their nose. Huh?
Yes, mm-hmm. It definitely is, because it's not, you know, what's in their exhibit normally, so...
Gotcha.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
We're just trying to dispel urban myths here.
About zoos, right. If anyone has any urban myths about zoos they'd like to dispel, please call in 530-752-2777. We've got Jamie and Robin here talking with us about the Sacramento Zoo. So, what's going on at the Sacramento Zoo? What events are coming up?
We have a lot of stuff coming up at the zoo this year, and the most pressing thing is on the 17th of February. It's a Tuesday night at the Crest Theater. We have Jack Hanna that's coming out, and he's going to do a lecture and a book signing for us, and it's all to benefit the Sacramento Zoo, which we're very happy that he's doing this for us and very grateful. The tickets are $30 for adults, $20 for kids, $5 off for zoo members, and it should be a really fun night. He's actually going to have some animals on stage and do a presentation, and you know, he's got great anecdotes about being in the zoo world for the past 30-40 years, so yeah. It should be a pretty fun night.
And they can call 264-5888.
Yes, for more information. They can also get tickets at tickets.com.
So that's 916 area code, right?
Mm-hmm.
916-264-5888. Maybe we'll get that phone number written down and have it for you later if you call.
What about new animals? Last time I went there, you guys had some kind of, I want to say they were tapirs, but they're probably not. There was in the back, and there were these little ground-burrowing mammal thingies that are cute and fluffy, and they had this, you know what I'm talking about? Dust from Australia.
We do have kuzmans. They're dark mongoose. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're fuzzy and they dig and they're really cute.
Yes, they are very cute. We were thinking something a little bigger, but they are very, very small.
They are very small, but I can't really even describe them. Maybe you guys could describe them a little bit more aptly than I did.
Well, they're small mongoosey critters, so they kind of look like a ferret, but they're not really ferrets. They're from Africa. And these guys are the sort of Rikki Tikki Tavi relative, snake fighters. And ours love to, they've got really sensitive sense of smell, so they're always digging and nosing around and rooting around in their exhibit. And they have really cute little whistly contact calls that they do with each other. So it's not just the big animals that are cool at the zoo. We've got lots of little ones that are really
cool. And the exhibit's really cool because it's a raised platform that gets you pretty close to the animals.
Yeah, you get pretty close to eye level with them. We also have a type of antelope that we just brought in that's going on exhibit in the next couple of weeks. They've been quarantine and since then, but they're Addax, and they're a type of antelope. They're great looking with the nice curly horns, and so we're very excited about that. We have a little bachelor group that we brought in.
And so we'll be part of a program. It's actually a national program for this antelope. They're highly endangered, and people, they're from the sort of Saharan Africa area, big region, but there's only a few hundred in the wild left because they're getting overhunted, and unfortunately.
The curly horns are, you know,
pretty.
Yes, too pretty for people to be able to leave them alone, apparently.
Do people go after their curly horns for the looks of the horns, just to have the horns, or is it something for, a lot of horns I know get they're ground up as herbal type remedies for various ills, or they're taken to be carved up into
It's all of that, and then they also are being eaten, and it's just an unsustainable harvest. They're just going and shooting far too many. The population can't keep up with it.
So the Sacramento Zoo is now helping to keep them alive.
We're trying. That's We're very fantastic. Excited about getting them in.
So what other neat species of animals are you? I mean, I was looking at the Sacramento Zoo website the other night and taking a look at the different animals at the zoo. There's one of your web pages says animals at the zoo, and so I started looking in, and so many of the animals at your zoo have stars next to them, signifying that they're endangered or are close to being put on the endangered species list. And I just found it amazing just the proportion of animals you have at the zoo, and you know how. Is this a priority of the Sacramento Zoo to bring in endangered species? Is that
absolutely? We work as part of an accredited zoo, which means that we have a pretty strict bunch of surveys and inspectors every 5 years. We're one of only about 200 accredited zoos across the whole nation, and so we work together with committees. So, for example, our snow leopard baby that was produced, that's part of, it's like a committee planning these computer dating things. And we bring in our male, and he's been genetically chosen to diversify the genetic base of this population. So we treat it, the whole nation's population, as one population. So basically, our male might go somewhere else and make another cub somewhere else, or he may be allowed, and literally allowed, like the committee says, you can go to breed. So our females produced a couple of cubs with two different fathers at our zoo, and that's good because we're trying to diversify the genetic base, and that gives us more long-lived population, but also gives that tiny crack of an ability to put some animals back into the wild, and that's only possible with some species because you need to have that habitat in the wild, or else there's no point.
And that actually brings us to a good point. We have a species of antelope called the bongo, and we just had one of them shipped out to be part of a process to start repopulating the wild. And Robin can tell you a little bit more about that.
That's pretty exciting. We've done this now with our bongo antelope, and then in the more distant past, we've done it with another species of antelope called an oryx, where we as a zoo community are sending animals back to, in this case, Africa. The bongo is from Africa. And we're partnering with a private person who owns a ranch. It's an American who owns a ranch in Africa. And they're going to use that as a staging place to start a population and then have a protected area where they can let the herd go. So they'll be back in the wild, which is pretty neat.
That's so neat. How is the change from being in a zoo environment? Like, how is your zoo environment for, like, the bongo that's going to be reintroduced? How similar is that to this ranch environment, and then from there, you know, what are the steps?
They definitely have to transition the animals, and what they might do, and what we've heard is most likely, is that our female will be bred and work as part of a herd on the ranch, and then her offspring would actually be the ones that are trained to go into the wild. So they literally have to train them to be aware of predators and stuff like that.
So it's not such a huge transition, you know, taking something that's been captive bred and putting it back out. They try to do it slowly so that they do have, I mean, it's in our best interest and their best interest to get them as comfortable and used to being in the wild so that they survive.
Right. So it's something, I guess, that, you know, we always think, you know, everyone loves to think of the nice, cuddly animals, and these are like the big animals that zoos are like, come look at our pandas, or look at our bears, or our snow leopards. Aren't they cute? And make them look all cute and cuddly. But then, you know, they are wild animals, but at the same time, because they're in a zoo, they're not really? I mean,
we tried. We have a philosophy of keeping the animals at the zoo as wild as they are supposed to be. We don't mm-hmm. tame them. We train them to be easily used for medical procedures. So we'll train them to go into a certain area every day so that if we do need to get a blood sample or something like that, that's the extent of the training. We don't train them to be tame with humans.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they do look cuddly and cute in the zoo, but our big thing is education. I mean, every single time we have an event or talk about anything we do at the zoo, the main focus is what's the educational component of this? What are we giving to the public and how are they learning more about the animals?
Yeah, so we realize the first step that we want to make with the public is to have some kind of an emotional connection with the animal.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the cute cuddly factor is part of that. But we try to go from that emotional connection to make them take some conservation action.
Even if it's just recycling. I mean, we start with the basics.
And it's amazing how many people don't recycle. So we do actually work on those kinds of steps and saying make some little effort for habitat, whether it's our habitat right here or whether it's the Asian snow leopard.
Yeah, I think it's a common misconception that a zoo is a bunch of bars and animals and people on one side and, you know, animals on the other side. It's an educational and conservation effort, and it's wide-reaching and broad in terms of its goals and what you guys are trying to do.
Definitely.
So,
oh, go ahead.
I was curious about, but I want to hear about the cuddly things, though, because, I mean, that's the heartstring stuff.
I want to hear about the snakes and spiders.
Well, we have two new rhino iguanas on exhibit.
Oh, cool. They're cuddly.
They're from forests and scrubland in Haiti, so they have a very endangered habitat because there's lots of habitat destruction.
And they look like iguanas with more horns?
They have special little horns on their nose, so they're called rhino iguanas.
Do those horns do anything?
Well, they're not really, really stout. They're more for looks, to make them look bigger when they're trying to impress their neighbors, other iguanas.
And mates, I'm sure.
Uh-huh, yeah.
We all know about the car thing. So, what else besides iguanas? No, I mean, like, I love iguanas.
You still have hippos there?
Yes, we have our one hippo, Jewel. She's like 37
or something
has she
years
been
old.
There her entire life?
She has been 60s, late 60s.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I think I fed her a watermelon once.
That's one of her special treats that we do on Thanksgiving, the day after Thanksgiving. We always do a treat.
Yeah.
There's some treats that we do that are kind of just for the staff, so we don't sort of do it during public hours, but at special times like the day after Thanksgiving, we do treats when we time, you know, have times that are advertised to the public so they can come and see, and that's one of those days.
Yeah.
I seem to remember being a little kid and like seeing like a whole watermelon mm-hmm. thrown
yes.
and it just caught yes. in the snap.
Yeah,
she'll
amazing.
She'll take huge pumpkins. She loves pumpkin, any type of melon, and she'll actually play with it for a little while and then just crush it to bits.
I'm just thinking, a pumpkin? That's hard.
It uh-huh. is.
But that just tells you how strong these animals are. They're just mm-hmm. amazing. I mean, she weighs maybe 4,000 pounds.
Jeez.
So she's pretty strong.
Well, in the wild, aren't hippos, like, you're supposed to watch out for hippos.
Yeah.
Aren't they quite aggressive?
Mm-hmm. They're very territorial, especially in the waterways. And so if you're, you know, canoeing a little canoe down the middle of a waterway and you go through a herd of hippos, you're in deep trouble.
Yeah, and they can come out of the water at like 35 miles an hour, which is the scariest thing to see that much weight going that fast. But,
it's
you know.
VW bug with teeth coming at you.
Yeah,
they can run they can run faster than a person, so you definitely don't want to cross a hippo.
No, but Jewel is nice and cuddly, and she likes watermelon.
Yes.
She's nice, but you don't want to jump over and go play with her.
Yeah, she's nice in her exhibit where she owns the territory, and we stay out of it.
That's fine. No, nobody needs to be making that close of friends with a hippo.
No.
Yeah, she's for looking, not for touching.
Is the zoo doing any kinds of renovations right now? I mean, it's a big thing in zoos across the country that, you know, animal welfare and the exhibits that the animals are in becoming much more realistic. And
mm-hmm.
what kind of renovations and which animals are you doing them
for? We were actually joking around about this on the way out here that we had a tagline of it's all happening at the Sacramento Zoo last year. Uh-huh. And this year we want to say there's always construction happening at the Sacramento Zoo.
Yeah, we always are trying to tear down older exhibits and do new exhibits. And our current one that we're working on right now is we're tearing down a primate exhibit cluster. It was four exhibits, and it's like a star shape. It's being torn down in the next little while, and we're going to put a very large lemur species and a mid-size monkey species.
I love lemurs.
So yes, it should be very neat.
Are you going to be losing some of the primates that you've got along the way in this process? Or?
Well, we managed to move one species is going to move elsewhere on grounds, and then, yes, we did have to ship back to the owners a couple of other primate species. So that brings up another point, is that actually we don't own some of the animals. We're actually loaning as part of this cooperative process. So that's handy, because then you can say, can you just take that back?
No, we're done. We don't need the orangutans anymore. They're very useful.
Yeah. We have an elephant somewhere out there in the world that will never come back. So we're hoping everyone stays very happy with what they have and don't start just sending your animals back to you.
Yeah, exactly.
Please don't send her back. We don't have room.
Can I ask you more specifically what species of primate you guys will have left, or which ones are leaving?
We, the red ruff lemur went to Oregon, and the French...
Was that the really nasty pair, or no?
No, you're actually...
Red ruff, they've got the...
Red ruff, yes.
They're pretty ones.
Yes, they're fluffy, and they've got the little ruff around the collar, and they're kind of a rusty red. Mm-hmm. So those we had to move to make room, and then also the Francois Langers, but we'll still have the ring-tailed lemurs. They're still on zoo grounds. We managed to put them in another space until we get the renovation done. And then we're hoping for sea fox, but we're not, we definitely have to see. It's a very long process to acquire animals and make sure you have the right exhibit and pass all the tests for, the requirements that we need. So we never know for sure, but that's what we're working towards.
Sea
so
fox?
We'll see.
They're the leaping lemurs. It's the big lemur that Zubumafu is modeled after. So everybody can sort of have a picture of what Zubumafu looks like with a white and black fur. That's what this one will look like.
Okay.
Oh, is that from The Lion King or something?
Kratz Brothers TV show.
I don't even know.
It's very cute. Yeah. They're also called leaping lemurs because they do tend to, across open spaces, they'll actually leap. Hence the name.
It's leaping lemur. is there any, other than the reintroduction of endangered animals into the wild, is there any research going on at the zoo? Is there, do people come out and do any behavioral studies or any kind of, I don't know, any research?
Yeah, we have approximately 5,000 hours of behavioral observations that go on at the zoo, and this is mostly by primate folks who are doing like anthropology courses and animal behavior courses. They come and look at different social interactions within the collection, and then we also participate. Our vet staff also help, for example, if they're doing a test on an animal and they do the annual physical, maybe somebody needs a sample of the blood to do a study that's, back east somewhere, they'll send them a sample of the blood, etc. So we do a lot of cooperative studies that way.
Sounds like a lot of coordination, a lot of different entities and different groups. All
it is. The zoo community, especially the accredited zoo community, spends a lot of time, talking amongst themselves and trying to figure out a plan of action. So,
is there anything else that you guys wanted to bring up specifically? I mean, we're coming down towards the end of our half hour, but I just want to make sure that you guys get everything out that you wanted to talk about, and then we'll go back to it. Finishing up our questions.
Outside of, obviously, the animals are a huge focus of the zoo, but we also do a lot of events. We've got events going on usually one or two times a month, and the next ones that are coming up are two community events, which are, they're no extra charge, it's just free with admission, and I have a California Celebration that's coming up on March 21st. It's a Sunday, and that's a diversity event, so we have a stage full of performers for the day, from Ukrainian heritage dancers to Chinese instrumentalists, and then we also have historical and cultural groups, as well as we focus on native plants, native California animals. So that's kind of a fun day, and it's all stuff that just is another thing that you can do if you come out to the zoo. And then we also have Earth Day coming up in April on the 3rd, and that's Saturday. We're doing it a little early this year just so we can, pull away from some of the other big Earth Day events, and that's just always such a good thing to do. So we love Earth Day, and Robin probably has a better idea of some of
we
the
have
participants
neat partners that bring down different exhibits and that sort of thing. And so, for example, the Department of Water Resources has this thing called the Water Burger.
It's
very cool. It's this giant stuffed fabric hamburger, and it has how much water it costs to make each layer in the hamburger, to make the tomato, to make the beef, to make the lettuce, and to make the bun. And so it actually is kind of, it's a little math problem for the kids, and they actually see how much water it takes to make just the little tiny bit of beef that's in a hamburger, so that they realize that eating lower in the food chain actually saves water as well as everything else. So it's really, really neat messages that we can get across.
Wow, you guys are really all about the education.
I think it's fantastic.
Well, people need the knowledge. I mean, that much is obvious. So
yeah.
That's excellent. Educational bent on everything.
It's lots of fun.
Yeah.
So that one's also just all those activities are included with admission. So we'll have stories and our wildlife stage show and all sorts of things going on.
Right. The other thing that's really fun that's coming up is we have a maze called the Chimpanzee Challenge coming in March, and that'll go through the beginning of the summer. And it's sponsored is it sponsored by the Jane Goodall, or is it?
It was created in partnership with the Jane Goodall Foundation, so a portion of the rental fee goes back to her foundation to study chimpanzees. And it's a really neat, it's a maze like you see in Survivor, like a 7-foot walls, and you have to go through and you have to not get lost. But it has questions, and if you answer the question correctly, you go the right way. If you answer it incorrectly,
you go
to a dead end. And it's got like little stations where you can brachiate like a primate, so that's the hand over hand monkey bar type activity. So it's mainly for kids, but you know, I think adults will like it too.
Yeah, it should be pretty fun, and that's another thing that's just free with admission, so you come in and it's an extra little thing to do. Can we come in and be big kids?
Yeah.
Yes, you can.
Yay!
I was curious. Several years ago, I went to a function at the zoo that it was like adults only. It was it was after normal hours.
Yeah, that's called King of Feasts, and it happens in June. It's the third Saturday in June. Robin's getting me the date.
I think it's the 19th.
It's a food and wine event. It's really fun. It starts at 5 o'clock, and it's I believe the tickets are $40 a piece for adults.
Okay.
And it's adults only, and we end up getting about 30 wineries and 30 restaurants out there, and you just eat your way and drink your way through the zoo. And it's pretty fun because the animals are completely different in the evenings when they're not used to people being around. All the cats are more active, you know. So it's really
their time of day, really.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a neat experience.
It's kind of nice because you can have a really lovely evening out, and you can also, you know, see a lot of stuff that you wouldn't see during the day.
Okay. Yeah, I remember it. It was just awesome.
It's very relaxed, and you just wander around.
And we have a couple of bands, and, you know, it's silent auction and like a raffle. So it's a pretty fun evening out.
And there's a lot of wine, too.
There is a lot of wine.
Nice buzz on it.
Keep lining up and bottomless supply.
Yeah, basically the trick is you get your food or your drink at one place and you go stand in the line for the next. And as you're eating or drinking and talking with your friends, by the time you're done, you're up at the front of the line and you just keep doing it.
Keep eating
all night
and
drinking.
And you get to hear, I mean, the real highlight is really all the different noises that the animals
definitely
make at night.
And we actually have overnights that you can actually, especially for families, where you can actually come and sleep at the zoo overnight. And people say that it on some levels it's very exciting, and they actually kind of scares them because they'll hear the lion roaring in the middle of the night, and you'll hear the flamingos going off, and it's like all these different sounds that you're not used to hearing at night. So they're very active. We've got a lot of nocturnal, and you know,
that's quite an experience.
Yes.
And you'll be able to sign up for those on our website, which is www.saczoo.com.
Excellent. Yeah. And seeing as how we're coming to the end of the hour, I'd also like to give out a phone number for Jamie, who is the membership and event specialist at the Sacramento Zoo, and you can reach her at 916-264-5888 for more information.
On
also
anything. And I just have a question, seeing as Valentine's Day is coming up here. Does the zoo have anything planned for Valentine's Day? We don't have any events planned for Valentine's Day, but we do have a zoo parents program that we kind of promote for Valentine's because it's a fun thing to buy for a loved one. And right now, if you do a $50 and above adopt an animal for a loved one, you get a fabulous adopt an animal tote bag that I just brought in that it's made from 100% recycled plastic bottles. So we're very excited about recycling, reusing, rebuying. So that's part of the
program. And one of our giraffes. You could adopt her. Her name is Valentine.
Yes,
it's her birthday on Valentine's Day. She'll be 9 years old.
You'll find that we're very sappy.
Excellent. I'd like to thank Jamie and Robin for coming out today and
thank you for having us.
Visiting us and talking to us about the Sacramento Zoological Society or Sacramento Zoo out by Land Park in Sacramento. Go check them out if you get the chance. There's a lot of great animals out there.
Yeah, we think the zoo rocks.
We do think the zoo rocks. We'd like to thank all our guests, William Gibson, Jamie, and Robin from the Sacramento Zoo. Thanks for listening to KVS 90.3 FM This Week in Science. Stay tuned. There's more great programming coming your way.